Well, you recognize that music, friends, and you might know that it's April 20th, which is a Tuesday, 420, as they say, some parts of our society, and it means it's politics day around here, not because it's 420, but because it's Tuesday, because on Tuesdays, America votes on the days when we do. Don't know why, Rob. Maybe you've looked up the reason why we vote on Tuesdays as opposed to other days of the week. I know a lot of us would like it to be weekends when you'd have votes. But I'm Doug Padgett, sitting down in Minneapolis and only sitting down because I got down here late. I was planning to be standing up, but it takes me a little bit to get set up, stand up. And so I'm sitting down in Minneapolis today, feeling the deep pressures of fellow citizens of my county, sitting in jury judgment of Derek Chauvin right now, just up the street from where I am at the Hennepin County Government Center in a jury room. And we're going to be joining in a act of solidarity and prayer with them in a mere 2 hours from now. If you're watching this live, if you're listening only on the podcast, then I don't know, it's whenever you chose to listen. But at noon each day that the jury is in deliberation, we are going to be joining together for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, the amount of time that George Floyd was under the knee of Derek Chauvin, to pray for the jury. So that's where I am. It's politics day. We're sitting here with Rob Ryerse in snowy Arkansas. Hello, Robert.
Hello there. 80 degrees yesterday. It's supposed to snow today. So, it's one of those things. And we are, Doug, we are 568 days away from Election Day 2022. Just 568 days away.
From the most important election of your lifetime.
Oh, goodness.
If people haven't told you that yet, that is the saying about every election.
Every single one.
This is the most important of your lifetime.
That annoys me to no end because it's just, so ridiculous. But eventually or sometime, it's going to be true because one of these will be the most important election of your lifetime. And I guess you need to vote every time as if it is.
Well, I guess depending on how long you live and when you lived, this could actually be the most important election of your lifetime. I don't know, like if you were born after 2016 and or after November 5th, 2020, this would be, most important one of your lifetime. For little Wesley Puck in our family, the second most important. For Brantley, it's the second most important election, of his lifetime.
There you go.
So, I guess, elections, Rob, here's one of the things I've been thinking about on this election business. And that is in this American experiment of ours, how much power of things that really have importance we put in the hands of your average citizen. Mm. It's something else when you think about this. And this struck me in the Chauvin trial, because as much as we're all working to change the systemic issues that lead to racism, that lead to continued narratives of white normative supremacy, police brutality, economic disadvantaging of certain groups because of their background, culture, race, language, all of those things, there's also becomes a time when the system opposes bad behavior. And in the Chauvin trial, that's what's happening.
This idea that we have a government and have a society that is built on, the power of the people is really something that is, it's an interesting tension, I think, that we have, because we've got this kind of we the people, government of the people, by the people, for the people, kind of ingrained in our mentality and something that, we have kind of very clearly held as a value. And yet at the same time, I think we often complain that we have no power. We act like we have no power. We are frustrated by things that we assume, we make these assumptions that everything, all the decisions, all the important decisions are being made by someone else. And I think, Doug, I think the point you're making is that we actually have much more power than we think we do.
Yeah, it sure seems that way to me. That and not all the time, right? There's most certainly times when we don't, when that power is taken away. You think about the governor and the legislature in Florida deciding that they're going to tell protesters that there's certain ways they can't protest. So the voice and the power is taken away. But then there are times when it's given to these jurors. And I think we step back. I don't know if you watched the jury instructions yesterday in the Chauvin trial, but after the instructions, when the jury was then going to leave the room, the judge tells everyone, which I think they do every time a jury's come in, is to all stand. That then the before the jurors stand, everybody else stands up, just like you stand up when the judge comes. There's this pageantry, this symbolism that says these people are the ones who matter. And I just think we should hold that really with honor in our society. And similarly with voting, right? Of course, it's Vote Common Good in Politics Day, but it's similar to that, right? We say, yes, there's all this system. Yes, there's all this structure that's in place. But then when it comes down to it, people go to ballot boxes, people place their votes, we count those votes, and then we determine a winner. And that person then has the power as given by the people. It's not passed on by the system. It's not passed on by birthright. It's not passed on by some sort of divine of the gods. It is passed because people say, this is the person that we want. And that's one of these other great moments. Now, sometimes, you know, when you live in a place because of how we count our votes and the person you voted for doesn't win, it can feel very disempowering. It's not like a jury where everyone has to agree. But there's something about it, right? There's something, it feels to me, that when we pursue a common good politic in our world, that the citizenry, that this notion of we the people, it really is. Now, and the question will always be, and we should ask it every day, who do we mean by we? And is there anyone we're not including as a person, right? Of course. And is there anybody keeping out? But that should be fueled and funded by the idea that this is a really wonderful and also scary moment to turn this over to 12 jurors. I think about the 74 plus million people that said yes to Donald Trump again. Can't quite wrap my head around that. So we're vulnerable to one another. Like, there's a real vulnerability that one juror or 50% plus one will make a decision to support something that none of us would. And we have had a history of that in this country. It's not like that's speculation. We got a long, long history of politics and juries being used and the outcome of them being for less we the people than we would ever want. So anyway, I'm sort of being nostalgic about the idea that we turn this over to these jurors and thinking about the rest of the places in our society where all that happens.
Yeah, it really is a tremendous act of trust that we put in one another. Mm. We are trusting these jurors to deliberate and to rule in a way that will, cause justice to be done. And we trust voters every time that, you know, we have an election, that we're trusting our neighbors to make wise and informed decisions about who's going to lead us. And certainly I think there's plenty of examples where that trust has, not been lived out well. But I think it certainly puts us in a position of vulnerability. And it's a reminder maybe that, of like how tremendously interdependent we actually are on each other. Mm. But I think when I think about this idea of how much power the people actually have in our system, it makes me think of, one of the issues that I kind of personally rail about all the time, which is the need for campaign finance reform. And I think that we absolutely need to reform the system, that there are systemic issues in how we fund our elections, that corporate PAC money is a corrupting influence on the system. And I think that Citizens United, which is a Supreme Court decision, needs to be revisited and ended. So there's a lot of things that need to be done. But the reality is that we the people have the power to enact those things without any law ever being changed. If enough people simply said, I'm not going to vote for anyone who takes corporate PAC money, you know, the whole idea of corporate PAC money could be ended because it becomes politically toxic to, you know, to be associated with it. That I think, you know, there's a lot of people that kind of feel powerless when it comes to reforming the system and things being different. And at the same time that we feel powerless, so we don't realize how much power we actually have. And yeah. if people are educated and motivated and inspired and all of those things, you know, this isn't like a kumbaya kind of thing. It's going to take a lot of work. But if that work is done, people are far in our system. People are far more powerful than I think we realize.
Yeah. When you really think about how money is used in politics, it's used to message and it's used to organize and it's used to create staff. But all of that has to translate into people casting their vote for this person. There are plenty of times where we've said, oh, one candidate, you know, just spends so much money. There's no way anyone can overcome that juggernaut. And then there's as many examples where the higher funded, the more wealthy candidates don't win the elections. You think in the presidential election, Bloomberg, you think about Hillary Clinton, you think about Forbes when they were like billionaires that have endless amounts of money. And that's not enough, right? All of that has to be used to motivate people to act. So the alternative to too much money in the wrong places until some changes are made about how that's going to happen. And yep. We can have long conversations about if any of the reforms people are talking about is going to actually solve that problem or just let very wealthy people run the table because nobody else can compete with the wealthy people, which is what something I'm deeply afraid of. I'm deeply afraid that so many of our senators, so many of our congresspeople, and so many of our presidents only run when they're wealthy, that they've made fortune and now they use that fortune to make it possible for them to run, that regular citizens don't even have a chance to run. And if you start cutting off the ability to get money from anywhere, so it's an issue. But when you really understand it, and you were a candidate and we've talked to lots of candidates, when you really understand what someone does with the money is ultimately they need to get other people to vote for them. So even yeah. then we need to say to ourselves, as I think you're putting so well, hey, if you don't vote for the person, they ain't going to win, right? That's what it is. It's not like if someone has a lot of money, they buy these votes. The biggest amount of influence of money in politics is being able to get voter groups to stick with a candidate. Not even individual candidates, right? All of us are thought about in the Politico system as being someone who might be part of a group of voters that you could motivate or inspire or repress or inflate the numbers of them. So the organizing that happens, it's really people work. And every candidate will tell you this, and every politician will say at the end of any policy discussion, hey, citizens, I need you to be on my side. I need you to raise your voice. I need you to take it to the streets. I need you to talk to your friends. Like, we need to have people hold to these ideas. So there's this people power, even in the conversation about money. And I don't want people to tell themselves, because there is a disempowering narrative that happens in our society and it shows up in politics pretty readily, right? Yeah. About all the reasons why you can't. And, you know, a therapist works on this stuff. Motivational speakers work on this. People that are leading a team at your work are always trying to come up with like, hey, we can be, you know, we can be possibility oriented and we can find solutions and we can move forward. All this kind of talk, because it really is true that that obstacles are just that. They're things you need to get over. And if we create too much narrative that nothing will change, that's the biggest thing that will repress us, right? Yeah. That's what every grassroots movement, whether it's people hitting the streets and calling for police reform, people hitting the streets calling for us to change gun laws or change environmental laws, that's really where the power comes from.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Doug. And it's, you know, it's so fascinating, like the ways that the voter suppression happens, that disenfranchisement happens. Part of it is through, you know, laws that make it more difficult for people to vote, as we've seen in Georgia and other places. But I think part of it, too, is kind of convincing people in a very subtle way that their votes don't matter. Mm-hmm. And you know, why bother? And I think there is that sense of if we knew the power we had that was already resonant within us, that it could be, you know, something that ushered in tremendous reform. And I find it really interesting as you've kind of connected the dots between our political system and our justice system, that now at this, you know, at this moment, just as we elect representatives to represent us in Congress and in other places, you know, so too we have this, you know, this jury that is representative of the people making a decision here in the Derek Chauvin case, and that power is entrusted to them, and it is, you know, I don't know about you, but maybe you feel this even more so being there in Minneapolis, but it feels like there's a collective kind of pins and needles moment where we're all mm-hmm. just kind of waiting for the jury to come back, and we don't know, you know, how to respond, what to think until they render their verdict and their decision is made public. Like, until that happens, I think everyone's just kind of holding their breath and waiting. And that is evidence of just how much power this group of 12 people has.
And that's something that in our society, you know, it's borrowed from the old English system of juries, but not every society has to be organized where, first of all, there's a presumption of innocence, and then the state's responsibility is to prove that you were not. And then that is going to be judged by a jury of your peers. In other words, not an elite group, not a set apart group who really even has any expertise. It's this ordinary people are going to decide this. And that ordinary people-ness is what it's always inspired me about the American narrative. You know, it's also for me as a faith leader, it's the thing that for the Christian faith that has always been attractive as well, is that it's that the Christian faith is one that says, oh, everybody's the same. It doesn't matter. Like, everyone has the same access to the same thing, and spirituality power is not held by some and distributed to you as if they're the power brokers that have a hold. Now, do people organize their religion in those other ways that are built around power
brokers? Absolutely.
For sure. Do people treat politics like this? Do they even treat juries like this? I will just encourage all of us who think about this. If you get a jury summons,
do it.
Hold that thing as a precious invitation into this system. But the number of times that we will all feel like, why is the world like this? And then, you know, people will be like, boy, if I ever had to get on a jury, I got three good reasons I could get out of that jury as fast as I can. I don't want to go sit in that jury pool room. I got to give up a whole week or 10 days or 2 weeks or something like this. Or I'm not going to vote, and that's not something that matters. Look, voting and being on a jury is not like trying to win a raffle, you know, as somebody who never signs up for raffles because I never win them. And then people who run raffles say, that's why you don't win them, you know, because you never sign up. That's not what we're doing. We're not looking for luck. Like, maybe you'll vote and then maybe somebody will pick, or maybe you'll be on a jury and then maybe the verdict will come out in a way that you like. This is the power that's distributed to us and given to us. And we should look each other. And then whenever somebody's not allowed that power, when they're not allowed the power to vote or to be on a jury or to be represented or their voice isn't listened to, then we pay attention to that because we hold this voice of the people so precious. That's my little connection. Can we talk a little bit about Walter Mondale? He was one of the vice presidents of the United States. He's a Minnesotan. You know, we've had two vice presidents from Minnesota. We're a very vice president kind of state. We don't give you presidents. We give you one step down. We're a humble people.
Who's the other?
Hubert H. Humphrey. Hubie Humphrey. Now, Hubert Humphrey, little fun fact, Hubert Humphrey was the vice president for Lyndon B. Johnson. Lyndon B. Johnson was a harsh and rough and tumble and fairly nasty fella. He would say things like, I want a vice president that's so loyal to me, he would kiss my ass in the window at Macy's. Like public humiliation. That's how I think of a vice president. So Walter Mondale was mentored by Hubert Humphrey, and Humphrey said, hey, if Jimmy Carter picks you, which he did, to be your vice president, you got to renegotiate a deal because Lyndon Johnson made my life horrible. Walter Mondale comes in, changes the vice presidency, turns into something great. He just died yesterday is the reason I'm bringing it up. And as you joked earlier, that didn't seem like news to you. You were pretty sure Walter Mondale had been dead for decades. If you've ever even heard of Walter Mondale. But, you know, look, there's only been 49 vice presidents of the United States, which I guess would be right. I just thought there were more for some reason. I don't know, with assassinations and all. And all of those have been white men until Kamala Harris, which also sort of struck me today, right? Just what a monumental change that is.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the great legacies of Walter Mondale was when he was the presidential candidate, the Democratic nominee in 1980, after serving as vice president, or in 1984, sorry.
84,
It didn't go so well for him. Quite frankly, one of the most crushing defeats in electoral politics history. and you know, it's really amazing when you think about like the red and blue maps that get shown, you know, nowadays, and how divided we are. You know, the map from 1984 is just like stunning when you see it. But one of the great legacies of Walter Mondale is, and I hope that history will hold it this way. It's not so much that he was defeated so resoundingly by Ronald Reagan in 1984, but that his vice presidential nominee was Geraldine Ferrara, and the first woman to serve as a nominee on a national ticket of one of the major parties. Really a remarkable thing. And, you know, Geraldine Ferraro helped to kind of blaze the trail that Kamala Harris followed and is now seen to completion by becoming vice president of the United States. And Walter Mondale, you know, did that thing of not choosing another white guy. And really, it's a great credit to him.
Yeah, in 1984, growing up in Minnesota and coming of age about then. So in 1980, when Jimmy Carter ran for re-election with Walter Mondale as vice president, I was sort of paying attention a little bit. I was 13, 14 years old. And it was, the vice president was a Minnesotan. So we kind of paid attention a little differently around here. Well, that loss in 1980 was severe. Jimmy Carter lost to Ronald Reagan, who defeated the sitting president. I think, you know, by like their 538, like he got like 496 votes, something like that. We'll show you a little video here in a minute of that. But like won just about everywhere, like just really handed it to him. And then in 1984, Walter Mondale becomes the nominee for the Democratic Party. So he was the vice president to a person who lost almost every state, then becomes the presidential candidate. It's Geraldine Ferraro. Then they lose in 1984 every state except the state of Minnesota and the District of Columbia. Yep. So he won his home state, better than Al Gore did, won his home state, but that was the only one that he won, right? And so coming of age then, like being aged 13, 14, and then 18 and voted for Ronald Reagan in 1984, I did. There was a sense that like Democrats were good people. They would do the right thing. Jimmy Carter, Walter Mondale, Geraldine Ferraro, but they're going to lose. Like the idea at that point had started to shift. You'd had all these years of Richard Nixon, who was terrible, and then, you know, Ford, and then this little brief period with Carter, and we kind of thought maybe Carter could do something, and then just loss and loss and loss and malaise. So there was a sense that even though there were a bunch of people in Congress that ran the House of Representatives and so on, that the story was that Democrats were not going to be the ones who were on the rise and were resurging. So I'm of the generation that kind of came in when, you know, it was from Nixon through George H.W. Bush. So 1968 to 1992, there was one little blip in there where it was, you know, 4 years of Carter, which everyone sort of smirked at. And it was just a butt kicking in the political sphere, right? Yeah. So there was a whole mentality, but there was a sense with Mondale that they're good people and that he was going to do the right thing. And it was so forward thinking to have Geraldine Ferraro be his vice presidential candidate as someone who was a vice president and decided to run. And then what other candidate did the same thing, was a vice president and then ran for the nomination and picked a woman to be his vice presidential running mate?
Joe Biden,
who was like around that whole time. Like he's a contemporary of the now deceased 93-year-old Walter Mondale. So I bring all that up because it's also about people, even in this story, right? The juries we talked about and citizens and voting. And then it's about who these people were. We'll show this little clip if it's okay, Rob. We'll show this clip. So this is Walter Mondale reading the results in front of the Senate at the Electoral College certification process in 1981 from the 1980 election. So he was the vice presidential candidate running with the president, Jimmy Carter, for re-election. They lost to Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. So then because Walter Mondale is the vice president, he then has to read the certified numbers and make it official. The very thing that was happening on January 6th when the Trump-supporting Republicans led an insurrection against our own government in 2021. So here's Walter Mondale reading first they read the number of votes that went to the presidential candidate, Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter, and then where we pick up this video, he's in the Senate, he's reading the results for the vice presidential election, because the two are elected separately in the same election, as we all know, and here's how that goes. So those of you are watching, you'll be able to see it, and those of you that are listening, I think you'll be able to make this out.
The state of the vote for vice president of the United States is as follows. The whole number of electors appointed to vote for Vice President of the United States is 538, of which a majority is 270. George Bush of the state of Texas has received for Vice President of the United States 489 votes. Walter F. Mondale of the state of Minnesota has received 49 votes.
All right. So if you're only listening on the audio, it might have been harder to tell what was going on. But when Walter Mondale reads that, you know, George Bush gets 489 votes, and then he says, and Walter Mondale, him of Minnesota, got 49, he starts laughing. He's like, and then, you know, he says it was a landslide. Yeah. Like it.
He turns to Tip O'Neill and says it was a landslide.
I know how to handle this one. He said, I did it. It was a landslide. And the Senate stands and applauds the man. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The political humiliation that goes into being a seated president and losing. Donald Trump and Mike Pence know what that pain is like, to be repudiated and thrown from office in your reelection. So did Walter Mondale and Jimmy Carter. What did Walter Mondale do? Did he have to fight with the sitting president to certify it? No, Jimmy Carter was gracious to the to Ronald Reagan, and he was Jim and Walter Mondale was saying it was a landslide, like we lost. That's how it goes, with a smile and a recognition that this is how it is. Now, I am loath to say, which I've heard lots of political commentators say, boy, what a simpler time. What a Camelot period. What a great, there was nothing about the time. It wasn't because it was 1981 and everybody was like, hey, howdy ho, we don't care about politics. No, I mean, this was still coming out of the civil rights movement. Nixon had been impeached. There were wars happening that the U.S. was engaged in with Iran. There was the Lyndon Johnson period of bare knuckle, cruel politics. You know, Nixon's nonsense of taking out bounties to have people assassinated who knew about his crimes. Like, it was a brutal political time. It's not because the time was better. It's because the people in those positions rose to the level. So Walter Mondale should be commended for being and then came back after that landslide loss and said, make me your nominee to run for president against the person that just beat us. And he was given a chance.
And he got beat even worse.
And he got beat even worse.
Did you see the email that was set up to be sent to Walter Mondale's staff and team upon his death?
No, I haven't seen this.
Yeah, so this is an email that was automatically set up to send, you know, to have someone send when he died, and this is what it says, and this is just an indication as we're kind of talking about just like the goodness of this man. It says, "Dear team, well, my time has come. I'm eager to rejoin Joan and Eleanor. Before I go, I wanted to let you know how much you mean to me. Never as a public servant had a better group of people working at their side. Together we have accomplished so much, and I know you will keep up the good fight. Joe in the White House certainly helps. I always knew it would be okay if I arrived someplace and was greeted by one of you. My best to you all, Fritz." What a just gracious and decent human being. And I completely agree with you that people could act graciously and decently today. And like they could if they wanted to, and it would make a difference. And it's not, you know, it is not that we have, you know, to, you know, bemoan, you know, how things have changed, how everything, all hope is lost, how the system is unfixably broken. Just, you know, if people acted with a bit more decency, a bit more grace, it would go a long way. And I think what we see here with Walter Mondale is a great example of someone who did that. And, you know, may that be kind of recaptured by our current leadership, because it certainly feels like, at least what we've experienced over the last few years, that it has not been that way.
That is so well said. And, you know, if we were giving out the Love and Politics pledge back in the 1970s and 80s, Walter Mondale would have gotten the Love and Politics pledge award. You know, he comported himself in a way consistent with love and his professional and political duties, as the pledge says. Now, hearing that email that you read, I wonder if he understood that this was going to be sent to people after he died and not after he moved to Florida. I look forward to joining the others, and, you know, hey, we'll see you down the road. So he must have had something that allowed him to take death pretty well. His father was a minister too. I just learned that today. I don't know why I didn't know that, but that's his background. And so, look, when these kinds of people pass along, let's not look back and just tell ourselves they were simpler times. They were, if there was a better time for a brief moment when someone like Mondale, or I would even say Jimmy Carter and others, even George H.W. Bush was an honorable, decent man. That's because those people chose to make it honorable and decent, not because there was something in the air. It was not a good time in the country. There were good people doing good things. And there are common good people now who should do good things. So if you're thinking about running for office, if you're thinking about supporting someone, if you're thinking about doing something in the public sphere, if you're somebody who already is for in the public sphere for some reason, like take these as your inspiration and as your challenge and as your way of being, that our politics doesn't have to sort of go down this road. Now, look, there were people doing very despicable things there. You know, yeah. Look, I mean, that campaign was brutal. There were people saying all kinds of things. There were lies being spread. There was voter intimidation, and there were still voter laws all over the South that were absolutely designed to repress the vote of certain ones of our communities. But there was also people who were trying to do the right thing, and now they're kind of heralded, and we can look back and say that time was so great. Let's make 2022 a great time in American politics. You know, let's feel free to do that. I was struck, Rob, by
Doug, are you suggesting that we should make America great again? Is that what you're suggesting? Or, man,
what do people say?
To coin a phrase?
Back when the former twice impeached failed re-election president was in office, what was it that people said? Make America kind again. They would say, make America like this. Look, what I'm saying is we should make America much better this time around. I was watching a CNN show, as older people do, on the people versus the Klan. And it's this special that they're doing that tells the stories of the 1980s when a young man was hung and lynched in Mississippi, and how the mom and others fought back and brought down the Klan in the 1980s. This same period of time, like some of these issues in our society, the same thing that put Derek Chauvin on the back of George Floyd's neck were the same things that were in place in the 1980s and the 1960s and the 1930s and the 1890s and the 1860s and the 1760s and so on. So they've been consistent, and the movement towards something better is our heritage work, right? It's our generation's work. We have to do this sort of as an ongoing practice. And just being reminded how tough these times were, but that our politicians can step forward. Now, I know other people who would say, like, well, yeah, but all that nicety didn't let them be in power. And if you want to be in power, the only way you're going to be there is to be ruthless and to be aggressive and to be cruel. And I hope that's not the case. That's how it
goes. Yeah, I agree.
Hey, you want to talk about the America First caucus that was stirred up? We talked about, Dan and I talked about this a little yesterday on the Newsy version. This was a shock to see that the entire system wanted to push back against Marjorie Taylor Greene and Congresswoman Boebert and others that wanted to put together a caucus built around, white Anglo-Saxon hegemony. I don't know if they know what any of those words mean, but
that idea that Anglo-Saxon tradition would be the motivating force. I mean, could there be a higher of a dog whistle than that? To communicate to people, hey, this is a white supremacy caucus. We're going to put Anglo-Saxon in the description. And, you know, one of the weird things to me was, as a part of this, was the desire to return to some kind of Anglo-Saxon architecture. Like,
yes.
It's so strange. Like, so strange. I don't know what they're kind of complaining about. Like, what's wrong with the architecture we have in America?
Yeah.
Currently, you want to go back to something different? What is this all about? It's so misguided and ridiculous. I mean, it is scary and dangerous on the one hand. Mm-hmm. And so ridiculous on the other. This is what we've seen with Donald Trump and with Trumpism now, and those who are carrying his legacy, is we want to laugh at it because it's so ridiculous, but at the same time, like, we can't just dismiss it and not take it seriously because it is so dangerous.
So apparently Marjorie Taylor Greene, a representative from Georgia, has said, hey, we want to form an America First caucus, but that document that was reported by Punchbowl News was, in her words, a staff level draft proposal from an outside group, and claimed she hadn't read it, but she didn't specify to anything in particular that she didn't agree with it. So now even Marjorie Taylor Greene, the representative who's the most prominent face of America First caucus, along with Matt Gaetz, who's being charged with child sex trafficking and law breaking, and a number of others in the Republican caucus. Even she, Marjorie Taylor Greene, says, I don't want to be near that stuff. Like, it's that bad that she's even saying to herself that she can't agree with it. So if you have a staff member who is finding a proposal for what this caucus would look like, and it comes to you as representing what this caucus is going to be, and it's so bad that you, as Marjorie Taylor Greene, can't even associate with it, it tells you how off the rails this America First effort really is. Like, in some ways, this is even more condemning of the fact that her staff are taking memos from outside groups to articulate what this caucus should look like and what it should be. Right. The influence, yes, the influence of outside money is a big, big deal. And it almost always comes not only with the dollars, but with the influence of ideas. That money doesn't tend to just come with money. You know, so it's not like a $20 bill is wrapped inside of a $100 bill. It's a proposal, a way of going forward, a way of understanding and thinking is what's going to accompany any of these donations, especially from outside groups. So the idea that Marjorie Taylor Greene and the other America First caucus, the other, you know, this, campaign supporting the failed president's attempts to make America great again through other candidates who carry on his legacy, they don't even want to be associated with the groups that support this stuff. This is so bad. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not like this is even a legitimate argument. It's just nonsense that's pouring out of these people.
Yeah, it really is. And is Anglo-Saxon, like, is that even a phrase that people use anymore? Anglo-Saxon. It's not just whites only. Like, it that cuts it even further, right? So, like, Anglo-Saxon is like British German kind of.
When I first heard this stuff, part of what made it very scary to me was that it was hearkening back to the things that were said by the organizers of Unite the Right and the rally that mm-hmm. happened in Charlottesville, yes. where Heather Heyer was killed by the car, where the Nazis marched with the tiki torches, where it was reminiscent to the early 1980s and late 70s when the Nazi party was having parades in Skokie, Illinois, and these kinds of things. So this big movement of thousands of young white men wearing polo t-shirts and khakis, carrying torches, saying the Jews will not replace us. And the other thing they were chanting at that rally, of which Donald Trump said there were good people on both sides of not only the slavery and the statues issue, but also on the side of this rally, mm-hmm. good people, as he says. The other thing they were chanting was blood and soil. And blood and soil was the argument of this: only certain people with certain bloodlines or were born on certain pieces of soil are the true citizens. This is something that's got huge movement in Europe. In fact, the alt-right movement in Europe and the anti-immigration movement in Europe and Brexit and all of that is rooted in the same argument that migrants and any kind of immigration brings in the wrong kind of people and dilutes the true essence of who we are as as a country, you can't have countries without borders, this argument, that your borders are to keep out people so that it doesn't dilute who you are. That argument, the blood and soil argument, is the same thing that they're arguing here with this Anglo-Saxon business about, you know, Germanic bloodlines going back to the 5th century. That the use of that phrase and that notion and that idea is a blood and soil argument that fundamentally says immigration is the problem. And that's what's opposite of the American expression. Like, it is so profoundly un-American that we would say that this country is made of anything other than a large collection of peoples from around the world and indigenous peoples from this land. That's who this country is a nation of immigrants, not a bloodline, not a particular ethnic group, certainly not a religion. It's the peoples from wherever they come that make up the we, the people. It's almost as if this caucus and Trump and the whole America First movement and the Christian nationalism, we'll talk about it at 7 p.m. Central Time tonight, is built around the idea that some people are the us and everyone else is welcome to live here, but they're not part of the we. And that's the big argument that's been going on in the last 20 years that, frankly, I, in my early 30s, I never would have thought we would be revisiting these ideas with the level of argument that we have to make to this very day. It really is an existential crisis that's facing this country.
Yeah, well said.
So when people say to you, like, it's about immigration and what about our border and how do we keep the drugs out and all of that, or they're sending us their worst people, all of that stuff is just fundamentally the most opposite of what we say this whole thing is about around here in this country. Yeah. It's and, you know, somebody in the conversation last week, I don't know, something about this said, well, we absolutely should have a national language. Like, English is the language that should be spoken. That's why our official documents are written in those languages and all that. And look, we do not have a national language. In fact, if you speak another language and you have a government issue, a government thing you have to deal with, they have to provide for you translators. They have to provide for you documents printed in your language or a translator who can translate them, because we don't have a national language. We don't have a national heritage. This is not a heritage. So again, I don't mind take it hard on you people from the South, but when you say it's all about your heritage, the Civil War and the monuments and the flag, Confederate flag and all this, it sounds to a lot of people like what you're saying is that there is a true American heritage that you're trying to keep, not your own particular family line or whatever that, you know, happens to be like your own, you know, your own familial group. It's something different, which is why our politics cannot fall into heritage narratives. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of why, you know, sons and daughters of other politicians freak me out a little, frankly, to be honest with you. I don't like the idea that somebody whose dad, mom was a representative, then it kind of moves down the family line. Like, I'm sure that's going to happen. That's going to be in there, but let's not have that be like, let's point that out and be like, whoa, that's a little, let's keep an eye on that and not have there be a dynasty of family heritage systems, and because all that is actually rooted in patriarchy, right? That who your children are is really a representation of who you are, and if they're successful, then that's a sign that you're successful. All this stuff, Rob, is just
something that pushes. It's all intertwined.
It's all intertwined. So what else is coming up on the political front that we all need to be paying attention to? I know that in Texas, if you're listening from Texas, there's some mayor races going on. I didn't know that the first weekend in May, open or early voting starts for mayors in like Arlington and Fort Worth, and like there's these little drips of elections that go on all over the place.
Yeah,
they're not just in November, and they're not just on Tuesdays. Even though we make the joke around here, that's why we have politics on Tuesday. But what else is happening in the world of politics?
I think, first of all, as we said early on in this discussion, that it feels to me like the country is kind of waiting on pins and needles to get the verdict for the Derek Chauvin trial, and that not much else is going to move until that happens. The Biden administration this last week had their version of Infrastructure Week, and they're pushing a massive infrastructure proposal today in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. A coalition of some of the most progressive members of Congress are going to be reintroducing a Green New Deal bill that certainly has the opportunity this time to make a little bit more traction than it did 2 years ago. Be really
is
interesting
that bill,
to see.
I know the first one of those was more of a framework. It was a Green New Deal structure and framework.
Yeah.
So this one's now a bill that's actually going to put some policy.
And it's specifically tied, from what I understand, it's specifically tied to the impact that the Green New Deal would have in cities, and particularly urban areas where climate change is impacting disproportionately marginalized communities, people of color, poor communities, and trying to address some of that with some specific policy solutions. So it will be interesting to see how that's received. That's coming from Ed Markey in the Senate, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Cori Bush in the House. It'll be interesting to see if there's any kind of movement towards making some progress. The phrase Green New Deal was not in our political lexicon, 3 years ago, and now it is, and that's pretty remarkable when you think about it.
Yeah.
And so now it's a question of not just can we change the conversation, but can we begin to get some policies changed? So there's some big things that the president's infrastructure proposals that are now working their way through Congress. This Green New Deal proposal is going to be added to that. So there's some interesting substantive things that are taking place. And I got to tell you, I would much rather talk about, what's the best way to invest in infrastructure, and it's going to make the best, the biggest difference long term. How do we address climate change, particularly how it impacts marginalized communities? Like, I would much rather be talking about this kind of stuff than, can you believe Donald Trump looked at the eclipse without sunglasses on? Look directly at the eclipse. Some people might think it, this is boring. Yeah, but it's also substantive. And I think that that's a really great thing.
This Ed Markey, Senator Ed Markey, is a curious character. He has really partnered up with the House Progressive Caucus to be the gateway into the Senate on this.
We should
try to get him on the podcast sometime. I would love to hear his perspective of where he sees himself in that, because all the benefit and all the power seems to sit with Joe Manchin, another quirky character as a Democratic senator, because he leans so much more conservative, or he would say moderate. But then Ed Markey's kind of also that quirky guy that's trying to leverage it from the other side. And that's a really, really healthy thing for the Democratic Party and for our politics as a whole, to have there be some debate within that party.
Yeah. And I mean, Ed Markey beat back a primary challenge from Joe Kennedy, who left his congressional seat to run against Ed Markey, and to run on his right, as to run as kind of a more moderate Democrat. And Ed Markey is a bold progressive in the Senate, held his seat. There was a lot of work that went into making that happen. But he really is kind of a quirky, interesting character that, when you think when you think kind of progressive champions, I'm not sure Ed Markey's the, you know, is the first kind of mental picture that you get, but he has been one.
Yeah. I mean, it's, he would be a fun conversation to have because in a lot of people's minds, you know, the younger generation would be more progressive, and Markey, I don't know how old he is, 137, 138, something like that. I mean, he's an experienced senator, right? He's been around, and you know, he's an old white guy from the Northeast. And so there's a sense in which people might think, oh, that's the old guard. But there's this old style progressive, obviously Bernie Sanders represents that, this old style progressive that is met now with the new style, the new generation of these progressives. Yeah. And we're all made better by the fact that there's women and people of color and that are expressing these progressive opinions. But there's been a lot of, you know, older black representatives that have held all this up, and some older senators as well that are in this space. Like it's easy to sort of move to do this in generational terms. He represents, it seems to me, a really curious crossover of the dynamisms of what this all looks like. Because look, if you compare that together with Joe Biden's willingness apparently to be something more than just a nothing's going to change presidential candidate. The guy, you know, I don't know if he broke a promise, but he really underplayed the fact that he was going to be very bold with his proposals once he was in office. It seems like Biden would support a whole lot of this stuff that was in the Green New Deal framework, and maybe that's now going to come through the Senate, if the Senate can do anything to make this stuff move.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see.
Friends, stick with us. Come back in, you know, I don't know, 56 minutes if you want to be part of the prayer for the jury in the Derek Chauvin trial. I keep worrying that, you know, my phone's going to light up and I'm going to get some message that the verdict is in. I, like a lot of you, feel very unnerved about that. And then tonight we have a session on Christian nationalism. Christian nationalism is a threat to this society. It's a threat to our government. It's a threat to our planet. And we want to help people understand what it is and how it moves. Amanda Tyler, who runs a group called Christians Against Christian Nationalism, is going to be one of our guests. And pastor, writer, influencer, maybe TikTok guy, Brian Zahn, who has spent much of his adult life trying to be a voice of alternatives to Christian nationalism, will also be with us. So Brian Zahn, Amanda Tyler will join us tonight at 7 p.m. Central Time. All this will show up in the podcast as well if you're just a podcast listener. And then tomorrow it's Faith Day, and Thursday it's issues that we talk about, and we're talking about the universe again on Friday on our Science Day, because we have a special guest with us, and including astrophysicist Paul Wallace. So a lot going on around here in the Vote Common Good world. Keep an eye out for us doing a big push around raising awareness of immigration, refugees, and asylum seekers coming this fall. We're putting together a little tour that'll take us from San Diego to St. Augustine, Florida. So from California to Florida, coast to coast, along the southern border, September, mid-September to mid-November. We're going to do it on bikes and cars and buses and RVs and stuff. But we're going to raise a little awareness and get ourselves moving across the country, try to get you all to care about a common good, immigration and border policy practices. So a lot going on in the Vote Common Good world. Thanks for being a part of it. If you're not on our email list, please head over to votecommongood.com, sign up for our email list, and don't miss the donate button when you're over there. It really does keep us all going and keeps the proverbial and literal wheels spinning. Well, common good politics day to you, Rob Ryersey.
Talk to you next week, Doug.